So good morning, Professor Setna. Thank you very much for joining us for this interview. As we've discussed ahead of time, the theme of this discussion will be ideas of replica symmetry breaking and spin glasses, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we dive into the heart of the subject, I have a couple of background questions to help us situate your work. And first, could you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before joining university?
I grew up in an academic household. My father was a professor of engineering at the University of Minnesota, one of the first cadre, I now understand, of Indian immigrants to the United States joining academics. He met my mother at Ann Arbor, and I was born there, and I grew up in Minnesota, and I was a math major until my senior year in college at Harvard. When I shifted to physics, I went to Princeton, and I became a student of P.W. Anderson.
So can you say a few things about how you got interested in physics and then to pursuing graduate studies in physics after that?
So I read every science book in the elementary school library. I was all through college, I thought I was a math major, but it kind of got boring, and physics seemed to be much more fascinating. By the time I was applying to graduate schools, I applied to one math grad school, two law schools, and about eight physics grad schools. And by the time I got admitted to various things, I had clearly focused on physics. Now, I thought at the time I wanted to be a high-energy physicist, and that turned out to be boring when I got to grad school. It's interesting, moving institutions gives you a new perspective. I remember taking Bert Helprin's statistical mechanics course, and I thought, boy, this guy is smart. And I asked, who is this guy anyway? And it was explained to me that he had recently come from Bell Labs and he worked on disordered systems. And I thought, oh, what's dirt, right? Why would I want to study something with dirt? I wanted to study, you know, quarks and grand unified theories. Later on, I recognized that dirt is really quite fun. It's really my focus.
So what brought you then to work with P.W. Anderson, if that was not your original intent in going to Princeton?
I read Ashcroft and Merman's book in preparing for the exams. And it was just fascinating. It was really grounded and interesting. And B.W. Anderson was the only person at Princeton who was doing anything in that field. I can't say his lectures in the solid state course were inspiring, but as I got into working with him, his written materials were really engaging and deep and thoughtful, and I've always tried to emulate that.
So during your graduate studies, you did not work on spin glasses, but did you hear about them? Were they part of the landscape of?
Of course. Phil Anderson would constantly be sending us papers that he got in the mail, and they would circulate through the group, and I would get inundated with all these mysterious concepts and thoughts, I remember a colleague of mine, another grad student, who was given the task of studying the long range spin glass and using replica theory, or he wasn't told to use replica theory, he just said, look at the long range spin class problem. And he got buried, and Phil Anderson eventually said, you should go be an experimentalist. And he became a great experimentalist at Bell Labs. And then another grad student got assigned the same problem, and he just ended up leaving physics. And then the third graduate student came along, Gabby Kotliar, and really nailed it. And Phil Anderson wasn't a nurturing fellow. He would give you really interesting problems, and then you would be expected to work on them yourself. And I managed to dodge that bullet. I was also not so interested in electrons. I thought electrons had all these, at the time, the intellectual framework of strongly correlated electron systems was very obscure, and all these Green's functions and quasi-particles and diagrams, and my instincts seemed to be better for atoms and things wiggling around, right?
So can you recall what was the group and Anderson's reaction to Parisi's replica symmetry breaking solution when that came out? Was this noted?
When was that? Was I still in grad school?
1979, 1980. Yes, you were.
Oh. Huh. Nope. I haven't a clue. That's a really interesting question. A really interesting question. This landmark result, do I remember any discussions of that? It's not that I doubt that there was some, but it's not associated in my mind with being in grad school or who was talking about it. My impression was that Edwards and Anderson always said this was really Edwards mostly. And it's possible that the whole replica theory part, except that, yeah, there was this replica theory in spin glasses, right? That he was interested in the long range spin glasses. So I'm puzzled. Yeah.
Okay. But when you did start working on spin glasses in the mid 1980s as a junior faculty, right, looking at the beta lattice model with David Thallus, how did this collaboration come about, and this interest, in a sense, caught back with you?
David Thallus came up with a beta lattice version of the spin glass. And Lincoln and Jennifer Chase, who at the time were married and are amazing mathematical physicists that have always been the only punk mathematical physicists I know of, they were really a walking tolerance test that I remember going into the. We were all graduate students together at Princeton, and at one point I was walking into the physics library at Princeton with Lincoln Chase, and we were talking excitedly, and the librarian came over and sort of said, "Can I help you?" with a clear indication that obviously Lincoln looked like a dangerous person. Leather jackets and chains and torn. Torn leather jackets with a safety pin holding them together, and they were colorful. But anyway, they said, they just heard Thallus giving this talk, and they said, we think we can do this, and And they started working on it. And my contribution, I think, was mostly to write the introduction and to guide them into the center manifold theorem, which turned out to be quite useful in guiding the mathematical proofs. But
so they were postdocs at Cornell at the
they
time?
They were postdocs at Cornell when I was a young assistant professor. Right.
But do you knew them from
and
before?
They went from being postdocs at Cornell to being tenured at UCLA. Okay. We tried to hire them, but we weren't willing to offer them tenure right off the bat, and UCLA caught them.
I see. So they had heard the problem from Talis. You did not interact with Talis yourself directly, or?
Well, he came to visit, okay, and gave a talk, and then this just happened, and we negotiated a little bit, and he was an author, but it was mostly Lincoln and Jennifer's work and with me contributing the introduction and a little bit of other things. And then later on, Gene Carlson did the same problem in a field, and there I was much more engaged in the details of the calculations.
I mean, do you know what brought Thallus to the problem or how he got interested? Did you know about his personal motivation?
So two things. One thing, I think, you know, we were all interested in spin glasses, and he finally found a way that you could do it without replica theory. And then it turned out that our solution suffered from many of the same diseases as the replica symmetric solution. Now, it's not that it wasn't a rigorous solution. It has to be a rigorous solution because that's what Lincoln and Jennifer do. But the rigor wasn't enough to make it physical. And the beta lattice has this, any of these branching trees has this property that you have to distinguish between what's happening inside and what's happening at the boundary or something like that. And later on, the replica theory people figured out that the proper limit to take to avoid negative entropy and things like that is to instead of having random boundary conditions at the edge, do something which rewired things at the boundary in random ways and then replica theory was the way to handle the beta lattice as well. And I found that revealing. I found that interesting and making us yet another Sherrington Kirkpatrick replica symmetric answer, right?
I mean, did you pay attention to the work that Mizar and Parisi in particular did on this problem much later, granted, but were you still paying attention to what was being done in say the one?
I'm sorry. So which work are you talking about? The beta lattice work?
Yeah, the beta lattice one R is one replica symmetry breaking cavity formulation of the beta lattice.
So two things. My style is to get fascinated by a problem and then adopt the tools, and yet to be admiring of tools that other people are developing without actually developing any real insight into them. So the replica theory was always something that I thought I had a broad familiarity with and a broad interest. I was, of course, interested in the fact that we'd gotten the wrong answer, but I didn't exactly scrutinize each step of their calculation and try to follow the details, because it is one of those specialized at the time very obscure specialized. The cavity method improved that, and message passing later improved that. And I feel like at this stage I might be able to enter it if I had a problem that I wanted to answer. But boy, they've done a wonderful job of answering a lot of different central problems in physics and computer science and neurology and all kinds of subjects. It's amazing.
To get back to the work you did then with your first, I think, graduate student, Gene Carlson, on this, so how did that collaboration come about? I think she overlapped with the Chase?
Lincoln and Jennifer, yeah. Yes. This was definitely a collaboration. And, okay, I don't know if you're interested in funny stories or not, but
sure.
But when you add a field, instead of having an elaborate central limit theorem that gives you the answer, you get a much more nuanced and interesting mean field solution. And adding a field to the Spinglass problem has long been a big deal, that there are big arguments between different groups as to whether there is a transition at all in a field, whether there's a glass transition. With Fisher and Hughes disagreeing with the replica theory people in various ways. And the opportunity to add a field to our calculation made a lot of sense. Now, again, in retrospect, it was probably replica symmetric. And I don't know, actually, if anybody's ever done the replica symmetry breaking in a field on the beta lattice, but we got all kinds of interesting, presumably new functions that describe the replica describe the beta lattice solution, and Gene and I worked a long time to find efficient and effective numerical means for generating these functions which were analytic in the whole plane, I think they proved, but still had all these wiggles and things. Mm-hmm. And in the process, Lincoln and Jennifer had sort of sketched out what they thought it would look like. And the paper was being written and had all of their diagrams and not any of Gene Carlson's final plots, because Gene Carlson's final plots came at the last minute. And at some stage, some error, the sketches that they drew, which were really quite realistic, but were just sketches, got published instead. And I remember talking to Lincoln and Jennifer, and Lincoln was, you know, they're punk, but they really embrace that. They would say, "Oh yeah, our figures were put in there by mistake." But he was very smug about it. I said, "You know, you're the postdocs. The graduate students spent a long time doing a really good job, really calculating these things. It's pretty sad that it didn't end up in the paper." And he looked a little taken aback. But they're good friends of mine.
Sure.
All three of them.
In these works, you acknowledge discussions with many people, including Fisher, father and son, and Mizar and Peter Matisha. How did these conversations about the works come about? Right, were these visitors, or were they?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure whether I talked to them or whether one of my co-authors talked to them.
Okay.
Geez, let me think. So who were the People we acknowledged again?
Danielle Fisher, Michael Fisher, and David Hughes, Mark Meza, Peter Modisha, Chris Newman.
I'm pretty sure Chris Newman was somebody that Lincoln and Jennifer regularly corresponded with. And Michael Fisher, of course, was at Cornell, and I talked to him quite a bit. Daniel Fisher is somebody I talked to a lot. It's a small community. I'm not sure what we talked about. I don't remember in either the first paper or the second paper, I remember a very straight line being plowed by my collaborators to the answer. And I'm not sure we got any deep insights from anybody else. It would be nice if we had found out from Mazard that we were up the wrong tree, but I don't think he knew that yet.
At the time. So what was the reception to these works?
I learned something from this paper, that what you don't want to do is have a really new, exciting result, and in the second chapter, put a really hard to read derivation of the basic equation. That people would read our paper, they would read the introduction, they would get all excited, and then they would go into the nuts. It's got a name. There's a construction that is the basis of the Wolf algorithm, but it was developed beforehand what was it called?
The Cuneo-Klein clusters or the FK clusters that preceded them? Is that what you...
FK? Yes. What is that?
No. It's a two Dutch mathematical physicists who are working on cluster descriptions. And
yes, that's it. That was the foundation of the calculation. Was this cluster representation, and it was just obscure, and it was perfectly rigorous and completely obscure. And later on, Eric Brannon, who worked with Lincoln and Jennifer as a postdoc, came up with a much more intuitive and heuristic, but rigorous calculation of the same relation. But the later sections were this beautiful center manifold theory and things like that. And that one chapter kept everybody from getting to the later ones, unless you were really diligent. And so since then, when you have a very complicated analysis, you stick it in an appendix or something and say, this is rigorous, you can go look for it, and then we're going to get to the stuff that's fun. I think a lot of people read it, and a lot of people found it interesting, and a lot of people found it challenging and figured out what was wrong with it. Or at least a few people did, and then everyone recognized they didn't have to read that bad section.
So you seem to have largely left the work related to cavity and spin glass, cavity calculation, Rebetta lattice calculation, and spin glasses after that. Why was there no obvious follow-up in your mind, or was this?
I mean, there was no obvious follow-up, and I didn't know replica theory, and the replica, I believe in working on problems that not everyone else is doing. And I also end up being dragged into things by my colleagues. So Lincoln and Jennifer thought here was an opportunity to do a rigorous calculation on a problem of current interest. And in fact, it got a lot of attention in the mathematical physics community, that Barry Simon was very insistent that we publish this paper in his journal. And and it's hard to do rigorous things though if you're doing spin glasses and things. The physicists really have an unfair advantage. So we found a rigorous approach to do the wrong calculation, but I'm not sure anything comparable has happened for getting the right answer.
So at about the same time, you also start paying attention to structural glasses, right? In 1991, for instance, you published a scaling theory of the glass transition in which you mentioned that the ideas proposing an underlying phase transition are appealing. But so in your sense, what was appealing about these proposals for an underlying phase transition?
Okay, so the regular glasses, I had this wonderful discussion with Daniel Fisher. I remember we were in Santa Barbara and we were swimming in a pool someplace, and he was telling me about how there was no particular reason why the energy barriers in a distorted system should have all energies that scale with the temperature. That temperature could be an irrelevant variable under the renormalization group, and then you would have diverging barriers. And I wrote two papers, one a rather obscure paper in which I made it very clear that a lot of the ideas here were coming from Daniel. And I was focused very much on this fragile and strong glasses, and some of which had very strong Vogel Fulcher laws, and some of them looked almost Arrhenius in the divergence of the viscosities, and they could all be systematized by this idea that you had a diverging barrier and non-universal prefactors or something could explain the whole range. And it seemed like a beautiful, simple explanation. And I'm not sure whether it's dead yet. I don't know, but it's sort of entropic barriers versus energy barriers, but I do still like it. Definitely applies to other random systems. The random fieldizing model definitely has a zero temperature fixed point. Temperature is an irrelevant variable. It's a dangerous irrelevant variable. Later on, we looked at the Ising model with three-dimensional Ising model with antiferromagnetic next neighbor interactions, which also has a diverging barrier as you coarsen. That's not at the transition; it's below the transition. The moral of the story though is in the second paper where we wrote it all down, I forgot to acknowledge Daniel. And boy, was that embarrassing. And at the time I was anyway, that was embarrassing.
Okay. In that context, did you pay much attention to the spin glass based work of Kirkpatrick, Thermalay, and Wallace that came out at about the same time? And if yes, how, you know, in what context, in what sense?
Okay. I remember a previous paper of Wallace that I I had read, and I found kind of sloppy. And I don't remember what I was complaining about. And I think at the time I was a little young and still intolerant of people who don't really nail everything they talk about. And I didn't pay much attention to it. I thought, oh, another Walden's paper. And he's obviously a very creative and inventive guy. And the fact that not all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted is a reason to not pay attention to him. And over the years, people kept telling me, oh, this thing of Wallenus and Thrumalai, and that turns out to be the key. It's a pretty technical replica theory calculation, which then they boldly asserted has something to do with configurational glasses. I was also still in the opinion that Phil Anderson kind of plugged into my head when I was a former member of his group. I would ask him, so what is the difference between glasses and spin glasses? And he would say, you know, glasses have a disorder that's part of the Hamiltonian, and spin glasses have disorder that's part of the Hamiltonian, and glasses have emergent disorder that happens as it freezes. And the idea that the glass transition could be studied by something that had disorder in the Hamiltonian seemed to be, that was the distinction. Those are two different problems. But the phenomena that we're talking about turned out to be very valuable, and I missed that. I've learned something else over the years, that there are things that I thought were just dead ends that turned out to be very important. Mode coupling theory, I really was the enemy of when it first came out, and now we're doing calculations that are very much like mode coupling. I remember thinking that this random matrix theory and universal scars and things were all kind of probably useless, and they turned out to be wonderfully important. So
what was?
But everybody has to choose what they work on, and I don't feel like, on the one hand, I do feel like all those other problems were really important and turned out to be useful, but lots of other people were working on them. Why not do something that's not so crowded? Why try to steal everyone else's light when they know what the interesting questions are? I don't have to work on them. They'll do it. I can work on something that only I have think is important.
By curiosity, what was it about mode coupling theory and its formulation that you were you didn't think was
Goetze and what's the other guy's name? They were working really hard to connect their mode coupling theory to glasses. And they had a giant number of sort of parameters in their theory that they could fiddle with. And there was this wonderful seminar that John Toner gave. And I hope I'm not embarrassing him by mentioning this. John Toner is an amazing guy. He's very creative. He's very clear when he explains things. And he's able to take situations where he gave a wrong answer and say so. And I remember his at very early age, he wrote an abstract for the American Physical Society, or I saw a talk, I've forgotten which, in which he said, Last year, I talked to you about the cubatic phase, and this year, I'll tell you that we haven't really found the cubatic phase. And he gave a seminar at Cornell, and he was talking about this really nice mode coupling theory that he had developed for a one-dimensional degree of freedom with short-range interactions in time. And I said, you're claiming that this one-dimensional degree of freedom connected to a heat bath is going to freeze in one of the two wells? That can't happen. And he sort of was taken aback, and he gave the rest of his seminar, and then he pretty quickly said, yep, you're right. The idea that mode coupling could have a transition in the system that you rigorously could prove couldn't made me think that the whole thing was ridiculous. And it turns out that it doesn't have a transition, it describes the caging. And the idea that you could have a self-consistent theory that describes something that doesn't happen, but is good far away from where it happens, that this was all too subtle for me. And I'm still not, I should go and examine the current status of all these things, but I think in infinite dimensions, there's a sharp transition in spin glasses that's described by the same kind of mode coupling theory. That's one of several transitions that happens. And I know they're Gardner transitions, but there was a second dynamical transition at a different temperature in spin glass. I remember browsing the papers and collecting sort of tidbits from them, but never really tunneling in and figuring out what was going on.
So after a sabbatical at Nordita in 1991, 1992, you moved on to the study of hysteresis and avalanches. Was there in your mind a connection between these topics and the work you had done on glasses and spin glasses? And if not, what drew you in this other direction?
So what drew me in the direction was a wonderful conversation I had with scientists at Barcelona University. I had been working on tweed in martensites, and they were experts on martensites, and one of them might have been Planus, but I think it was one of the other people there, showed me this experiment where he'd taken this martensite and he had stretched it and let it contract again, and stretched it and let it contract again, and it would form exactly the same hysteresis loops each time. And so that was really the primary focus of the original paper. And it was a random fieldizing model, and of course that was part of disordered systems, and I was happy with that. But it had avalanches instead of thermal behavior, and I'm still a little vague that Mark Robbins had been using the same random fieldizing model to describe water entering oil-bearing rock in his work with one of the oil companies that he was a consultant for and used to be a postdoc or a member of. Mm-hmm. And so he had already seen jerky motion of the front and different, so that's the depinning version of the random fieldizing model, and we were studying the other version. And it's sort of like I still think in some ways the memory effects that the hysteresis loop retracing, return point memory, and Alan Middleton's no passing rules. They may be the deeper thing, but the avalanches and the renormalization group were the place where the light was good, and it's been great fun ever since. Another thing, I think it might have been around that time that Michael Fisher and Ken Wilson left Cornell, and so I didn't feel like it was somebody else's job to do all that renormalization group stuff. I was the local expert now, so it made sense for me to spend more time thinking about it.
During your time at Cornell or elsewhere, did you ever teach about replica symmetry breaking or spin glasses?
I've never taught about replica symmetry breaking. I have maybe I think a special topics course once. I did teach a whole course based on Mazzard and Montaneri's book.
Okay.
But the parts of it I paid attention to were the parts that didn't involve any replica symmetry. In fact, I don't think they have much replica symmetry breaking in there. They're really talking about algorithms and things that aren't as mysterious as the cavity method.
So when would that be? Can you give us a bit details of?
Let me see if I can dig that up. No. Teaching.
If it's hard to find, we can also annotate it in a later.
Yeah, study. No, I think I'll have to find it later. Right.
But what's the context? You were just interested and curious about the book, or what brought you to teach that?
I thought it was important. I thought there were all these advances, and the book was just wonderful, and I wanted to talk about. I still have an exercise on the random energy model that I stole from their description. You know, my technique in generating exercises, I find something really interesting in the literature, and then I see if I can distill it into a form that I can assign to graduate students and have them work for a few hours and get the answer. And that was a really fun.
So in your own statistical mechanics textbook, you briefly mentioned spinning glasses, replica symmetry breaking, and the cavity methods, but you do not provide any technical details on any of these systems. Why in particular that choice?
Well, the book is aimed at entering graduate students and need to know a broad variety of subjects, and There's one chapter on linear response. And linear response is the bread and butter for experimentalists everywhere and has all kinds of interesting relations that weren't invented in the 20th century, or the 21st anyway, they aren't recent. Fluctuation dissipation theorem and things like that, you know, you have to hear about that. And there's one chapter on all of the renormalization group and scaling and things like that. So it's not primarily because I didn't know enough about the subject to say something simple about it. I think I would have plunged into it and found something that I could say that's clear and obvious. It's also, you know, I was a postdoc with Eric Sigia. And the Martin Sigia Rose transformation is really beautiful and interesting, but boy, it's a little bit advanced for people who just have noticed what a Green's function is in the beginning of the course, to get them to trace over all the possible trajectories and have a delta function in the right spot. I wanted to emphasize the conceptual aspects and not the techniques. And I'm still kind of looking for that. I'm still kind of looking for a way of pulling out the important concepts and about disordered systems. I'd like to be able to talk about dangerous irrelevant temperature and how it slows things down. And that makes me feel like I've taught them something about the glass and not about how we prove something about glasses. And if that came out naturally from cavity methods version 7, that would be just fantastic.
I mean, you're just in that book, for instance, you do describe glasses a bit more than spin glasses, but when you do so, you don't really mention anything related to Wollnis kerpetic thermali or RSB ideas, but you do mention Nelson's geometrical frustration ideas, however. Why that choice?
But I mean, that was the statement about homotopy theory, that I have a chapter on homotopy theory. Homotopy theory is a wonderful way of understanding defects in solids and defects in liquids and liquid crystals. And yet it's a slightly empty theory. You can figure out what the defects are in a liquid or a liquid crystal pretty straightforwardly without ever having homotopy theory. It just gives you a nice framework to hang it on so that you're not always reinventing basic concepts. You have a sort of a machinery. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to tell them something that was useful, was deep and interesting that came out of it. And the one thing is that if you have non-abelian defects, they don't cross. And there are only two examples. There's biaxial pneumatics, and then there's metallic glasses. So you end up talking a little bit about metallic glasses, even though the Nelson's theory never did. I think I say that. I think this was a theory for metallic glasses, and maybe the metallic glass get stuck because the defects can't cross, but that's never been turned into a real calculation, I think I say.
You do, yes.
And so, you know, I'm not trying to say that Nelson's theory was more important than the recent stuff starting with Wollanus and so on. It's also It's also that if I point people to, if I point, when I put in references, I try to put in things that if they look them up, they can get it. Nelson's papers were pretty physical, pretty grounded, pretty, you know, you put the atoms this way and they pack this way and then you get icosahedra and then something. And the connection between Wallenius's work and real glasses, you need to really be engaged to make that connection, to understand what the connection might be, to appreciate it. So far that I didn't get it. And so if I say, take a look at this paper, they'll get lost.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about that era that we may have missed or overlooked, or these ideas?
It's not about replica theory. But one of the stories, morality tales I tell people, has to do with the random fieldizing model. You may remember in that era, there were two competing theories for the random fieldizing model. There was the supersymmetry theory, which claimed that the random fieldizing model had the same critical properties as the Ising model in two lower dimensions. And then there was the bonehead theory that Jeff Grinstein promoted, which looked at clusters and things and said that there had to be a transition in three dimensions and it was borderline in two. Jeff Grinstein was on both sides. The theorists, everybody appreciated the supersymmetry arguments and everybody agreed that he might be wrong, but they didn't understand why they would be wrong. The experimentalists were there were two groups of experimentalists, Jacarino's group and Bergino's group on opposite coasts. And they fought horribly, I understand, from Steve Kibbleson. I hope Steve doesn't mind my mentioning this, but I always thought that was sad, that they would, disparage one another's work and reject one another's grant proposals. And maybe I'm maligning somebody and I'll get sued for libel here, but they were both befuddled by the diverging barrier heights. Nobody knew at the time that this system was glassy, that you couldn't reach equilibrium by cooling. And if one of them got the right answer and the other one didn't, it was a little bit of an accident because neither one of them could guarantee that they're really exploring the equilibrium state. And that turned into a really interesting project. But in the meantime, there was a bunch of rather unfortunate fights and it's a natural human thing to ignore or belittle people who disagree with you, and you should be cautious about that. You should be respectful. You should be broad-minded, and you should be thinking hard about how both of you can be right, rather than being so sure of your own worth that you can't recognize the possibility that somebody else has something useful to say. It's tricky sometimes. People abandon fields when they're proven wrong about something. I believe Parisi had this theory of the strong interaction where he, it was something, he could predict the mass of the proton by using tree level something calculation, and it was a big splash for a little while, and then it turned out that symmetry gave him just as good answers, and it wasn't a good first approximation. I don't know. Anyway, some people leave the field when they are found wrong about something. I didn't do that with spin glasses. I was happy to find out the spin glasses and the beta lattice were more complicated than I thought. I just didn't have any new ideas about it. Where did I get? Oh yes. This may be a whole why did I start talking about this? I was talking about random trivializing model and how you should be tolerant of other people and welcome the fact that you might be wrong. I think that's a very valuable lesson. It's always better to be right. It's always better to be the first person or an early person to recognize when you're wrong and say so. It takes courage that John Toner has, in later life I've seen a few other people, to be able to recognize an error and correct it and not feel so embarrassed that you can't continue in the field. All those things are useful and important.
In closing, do you have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I don't believe I have anything. I think I have all my emails since the dawn of time, but I'm not even sure we had email in those days. I don't have any correspondence.
With Thales or with the Chase once they left, or you would be corresponding over the phone, or?
Geez. What kind of correspondence do people have that they mention when you ask them this?
Some of them have paper letters that they've saved in folders, yes.
I guess I usually collaborate, in those days at least, with people that I was in the same building with. So Lincoln and Jennifer and I didn't have long letters to one another because we're all sitting in the same place. We would just talk. I don't remember any long distance collaborations. There was a brief, two or three emails back and forth with Deepak Dhar on the beta lattice random trivializing model that I could probably dig up, but that's not replica theory and it's not even spin glasses. I don't think I have anything.
Okay. Thank you very much for this conversation. It's been quite interesting.
This is great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Francesco, as well.